think we've done it.
All right. Well, for those of you who said we could never start this call with another bunch of beeps for the next 5 minutes, we think we've done it. So welcome, everybody. First of all, Kia, let me make sure we didn't mute your line when we muted everything else. Can you say something real quick?
Yep. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah, perfect. Okay, good. All right, well, welcome, everybody. Welcome to the February Citizens Climate Lobby call. I am in Denver, Colorado, where we have a regional conference with over 90 people, 45 people at the Group Start workshop this morning, doing some really good work over the next day and a half. And I know some of you are still hosting cities, even though there's people here from Arizona, Colorado, Montana, Utah. So people from all over the Mountain West area. It's just great having them here. I particularly also want to welcome the groups that started since last month's call. So in California, that includes Long Beach, Modesto, Santa Clarita, Stockton, Ventura, and Victor Valley. In Colorado, Greeley. In Connecticut, New Haven. London, England. Love that we're growing in Great Britain. I always like to steal one of Winston Churchill's lines, you know, the U.S. and Great Britain, two countries separated by a common language. Georgia, Chattanooga, Louisiana, New Orleans, Michigan, Kalamazoo, Missouri, Springfield, and Texas, Denton. So if you're in a new group, welcome. It's so great to have you aboard. There's three things we do every month. One is we educate ourselves, and we are so excited to have Kia Chatterjee from U.S. Climate Action Network on the call today. We have a laser talk that we're going to ask you to practice with your group before you leave today. We want to feel like every single month, not only are we to have a broader understanding of dealing with the issue, but in addition to that, that we're more articulate. And in addition to the laser talks that we provide every month, there's another 40 talks on our website. So if anybody ever asked you about China or jobs or the economy or how you contrast the carbon fee to cap and trade, all of that's there and useful information to you be practicing. And then we all get into action. So we'll go over the focused actions that we want to do this month, both in the U.S. and Canada. And again, if this is your first time on the call, welcome. It is really, really great to have you. Okay, so our guest, Kia Chatterjee, is the executive director of the U.S. Climate Action Network. She has a pretty long resume in this arena. Prior to joining UCAN, she was the senior director for renewable energy and footprint outreach at the World Wildlife Fund. She was also a climate change specialist at USAID. We're going to start by asking her to talk a little bit about U.S. Climate Action mission, but hopefully we'll have time also to talk about her book, which I think is just fascinating. I think you're all going to want to hear about it, so hopefully we'll have time for that. If there's time for questions, we'll start in St. Louis and then Boston Metro West, and then I think it's Erin, Ontario. And then Santa Clarita. So that just depends on if there's time, but hopefully there will be. So if there's time, we'll take questions. So, Kia, I know that the USCAN's mission is to support and strengthen U.S.-based civil society organizations' influence on the development and implementation of local, national, and international climate policy and action. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, what you're hoping to accomplish there, you know, any particular goals that brought you and the kinds of things that are interesting in what you and USCAN is doing at this point? And first of all, welcome and thank you so much for making yourself available on a Saturday.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really exciting to hear all the groups chime in from all over the country. And really, that's a big part of that connectedness all over the country and all over the world is a big part of why I came to U.S. Climate Action Network. Our mission is kind of long, but I always think of it in a really short way, which is that it's to make sure that we're stronger together than we would ever be on our own as the set of organizations that work on climate change. So Citizens Climate Lobby is one of our 133 members, and my job is to make sure that people can find each other, talk to each other, and understand how, even if it seems like their work is really different, they actually are supporting each other. So, for example, I would make the argument that our member organizations that are working to oppose the Keystone XL pipeline are actually making it easier to propose a fee and dividend. And, you know, because you can go into offices and say, look at all those crazy people trying to stop the pipeline. You know, you don't want to go one project after another and have people going after it. This is a simple way of doing it. And so, and it gives you that argument. And so I think sometimes in not even the most obvious ways, we actually are much, much stronger together as a group of 133, both small and large organizations that are working to advance climate change. And we were actually started in 1989. a long time ago in a small room in Germany. So it's been 25 years. And the idea at the time was that we wanted civil society to have a way to coordinate in order to influence the UN climate talks. And so, of course, in this year, as we're moving towards a UN climate agreement in Paris in November and December being negotiated, that's a huge part of our history and culture as an organization, is making sure all our member organizations have everything they need to fully engage and feel coordinated in the UN climate agreement in Paris.
Great. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, I thought I lost you for a second there. Were you pausing there for a follow-up question, or did you want to continue for a couple of minutes?
Oh, I can keep going.
Please do. I'm loving what I'm hearing, and I particularly love, because one of the things people always say to me is, why isn't everybody working together? Everybody should be doing the same thing, and I don't agree with that. There's so much that needs to be done. I'm so happy that Big Green's protecting EPA authority and 350 is working on, you know, a broad public outreach. So I do think there's so much to do. It's important that there's so many players, but sorry for interrupting you. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, network theory is a huge part of the way that people think of the world right now. And so there's a great, actually, Harvard Business Review article on old power versus new power. And old power is, not so different from the power that we are up against. You know, the fossil fuel industry, big corporations that, have a tendency to spread misinformation about climate change, sadly. You know, that's what we're up against, is old power. New power is much more distributed and can be very, very influential. So it's a network, and it can respond to things faster. And so if you think about how fast attacks against our community come, you know, whether it's ClimateGate, and, you know, when they stole the emails of the climate scientists and tried to spread misinformation about them, or attacks, you know, with misinformation about specific companies. This happened when, the Department of Energy program that had given a loan guarantee to Solyndra was just very heavily attacked. It came out of nowhere. It came very fast, and there was a lot of misinformation. And if all our 133 organizations that are U.S. Climate Network, if we were one organization, we would never be nimble enough to even try to respond to everything that's happening, both the attacks and the incredible opportunities that appear before us. And so I feel very, very strongly that networks are actually a very strong source of new power. And so then the question that we have to tackle is, how do we make sure that people can find each other fast when they need to? Not all the time in coalition, but when they need to find each other, they're able to pick up the phone and find each other, and people are able to appreciate the roles that each other play. I came from the science community, so I came from working at NASA even before working at USAID. And so I always have this just central vision of what we are trying to do, which is just tackle the fact that the emissions are way, way too high. You know, I changed my career and came into advocacy because I was shocked in 2002, frankly. Like, I saw the sea ice data from the Arctic, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I realized I needed to change my career immediately. And so I started working on climate change, you know, within 48 hours, partly because I had a great boss. And then I moved over to USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and was working, internationally on climate change. But I very quickly wanted to get into advocacy, because I saw so fast that this was something where we were going to have a very, very powerful civil society voice if we were going to take on the fossil fuel companies. You know, for me, there's three core things that we have, I think, largely in common as a community. One, we see that there is a moral obligation here. You know, like, we'll talk about my book in a minute, but, you know, I have a child. I feel an enormous amount of responsibility to my own child, but also to, you know, our kids and grandkids more broadly, and also to other countries that have done really very little to cause this problem and are suffering the worst consequences. And I think as a community, we share this sense of moral obligation. I think a second thing we all share is a sense that we can do this. Like, we have solutions. We have tools. Different member organizations organizations have different tools they're working on, have different solutions they're putting forward, but we all fundamentally believe and know that we can tackle this issue. And that's really important, because a big part of our opposition messaging is that there's nothing you can do about it anyway. And we know that that's not true. We know it's very simple to solve the problem in many ways. And while we're probably at the point that we can't save everything, there is still an awful, I mean, the vast majority of things can still be saved. So I think that's something that even across 133 organizations we have in common. And then finally, I think that our groups in general have this knowledge that there's a reason this hasn't happened, and it's because there's a very strong and powerful fossil fuel industry that has a lot of sway in our democracy, and we're going to have to make our voices very, very loud to overcome the old power, the strength that they have, because that's the only reason we haven't made progress. We know that there are common sense ways to make progress. That's what's been standing in our way. And so I actually think in many ways we have a lot in common as a community, and we are the U.S. node of an international organization. So we're U.S. CAN. There's CAN International. And then we have these nodes all over the world. So there's CAN Latin America and CAN Europe and CANSA, which is CAN South Asia. And we have these nodes all over the world. And while we come from amazingly different places in many senses, we as a community, as a climate community, and I dare say a climate movement, we have a lot in common. And we are able to, I think, pull together at times when it's needed because of that. And I think that this year in 2015 is really one of those times when that is needed. In the run up to the Paris Climate Agreement, I've followed these UN climate agreements very closely for the past decade. And, you know, just like if any folks have been following like the trade talks, the trade talks always collapse. The climate negotiations somehow just barely, after 48 hours of no sleep at the end, seem to come up with something, but it's never enough, and that's very frustrating. And it's also always on the precipice of falling apart, because there's so much understandable animosity in those negotiating halls, because you're dealing with a lot of small island nations and a lot of countries that really have done very little to cause this problem and are facing this existential threat at this point. You know, like they're thinking about their, you know, whether or not they're going to have to lower their flag from in front of the UN and not exist as a country, and where people are going to live and what that means for them. And so it is a very emotionally charged place to be, and the more that as civil society we can join together and make concrete demands that show that the pressure is on, and that we as civil society, we as the people of all of our countries, we know that more can be done.
Great. Okay. Well, again, let me just give heads up to people. If I want to talk about the book for a second, but if there's time, we'll start in St. Louis and then Boston Metro West, then Aaron, which I'm not sure is Ontario, but I know is in Canada, and then Santa Clarita. Let me just ask you about the book. So you wrote a book called The Zero Footprint Baby, How to Save the Planet While Raising a Healthy Baby. The first question I have is it in fact true that how you started writing the book is your friends came to you and said, hey, you're about to have a baby, you don't have a car or a refrigerator, how are you going to do this?
Absolutely.
Is that close to actually what happened?
It is very, very close to what happened. You know, when I was pregnant, my husband and I had lived what most would consider a pretty unusual lifestyle at that point. It's a long story, but we had finally gotten to the point where we had solar panels, we didn't have a car, we actually didn't have a fridge, which is the most shocking thing to people. I'm not going to lie, people find that very strange. But people get used to crazy things. And the true story behind that is actually that we got into a huge fight with our utility, and they at some point after 3 years of overcharging us said that they only had one thing in our records about the history of our billing problem, and it was that and they said this to my husband, they said it's that your wife gets irate easily, and I was like, oh no, they've never seen irate. And I cut off our electricity, which is why we didn't have a fridge and why we got the solar panels, also because of my deep commitment to climate action, of course, but there there were multiple parts of it. So we were living and a pretty extreme lifestyle, and I think that for me it was just this question of, can we keep living this way with a baby? Can we actually continue year on year to lower our carbon footprint? And how do we do that? And for me, individual action is one of those things that is actually very important to me personally. One, because I think it helps me feel in line and more authentic in my work. And two, it's not that I think individual action will change the world, but I do think that people need to see, you know, normal people living lifestyles that essentially are, you know, as much as you can without having a price on carbon, really not very reliant on fossil fuels. You know, people look at me and they see like generally during the week, a woman wearing a suit in a office building, and at school we're a normal family. And then when they find out that we're essentially off of fossil fuels, they're intrigued and they're interested. And then maybe it doesn't seem as scary to put a price on carbon, because it would be a while even before we got society to the point where, the way that our family lives. And so, but the baby years presented, of course, their own challenges. So I spent a lot of time just doing reams and reams of research about, cloth versus disposable diapers and breastfeeding and childcare. And, I got to the point where I had probably a foot high pile of peer-reviewed literature on each of these topics that I had just gotten for myself. And the reason I wrote the book was because I just thought it was ridiculous that I had to do so much research just to get very, very basic information. And then it ended up being, a challenge for us. In the same way lots of people, count calories, we count our kilowatt hours. And it just became a challenge to see if year on year we could continue to reduce our carbon footprint.
Amazing. Just absolutely amazing and so inspiring. Great. All right. Let's go over to St. Louis. Carol, does anybody there, you would have to *6 your phone to unmute it. Is there a question that you wanted to ask?
Hi, Mark. This is David Henry has a question.
Yes, Kaya. It's a very inspirational talk that you just gave, and I'm thrilled by the talk about personal responsibility, for example. I've stopped driving recently, and my daughter's sitting right here. She may not be too glad to hear that, shutting off the refrigerator sounds like a great idea also. It is thrilling to work up to the Paris conference. And one other thing that's very thrilling is that the Pope's encyclical is coming out very soon.
Yeah.
And I just want to hear your thoughts about that and how we might leverage the Pope's encyclical in terms of raising awareness among all of these groups.
Yeah, so it's a big year for climate action. Another thing I'll flag is that this is the year of the 5-year anniversary of the BP oil spill, the 10-year anniversary of Katrina and Rita, and the Pope's encyclical is coming out in June, and the Pope is in fact coming to the U.S. and addressing a joint session of Congress on September 24th, which is going to be very uncomfortable for a number of Republicans who are both climate deniers and Catholics to be, sitting there and listening to the Pope talking about the moral responsibility that we have as society to tackle climate change. And I think it's going to provide for a really important opening to shift some views in the Republican Party. There are a lot of things being thought about and planned. I've heard about, potential pilgrimages, fasts, for climate action. I think within the Catholic community, there's just an incredible amount of excitement about what can be done on climate change, with the Pope's visit in particular. The encyclical comes out in June, and then the visit is in September, which is also tied to the UN, the next UN climate summit that's just before Paris, which is in New York in September, and the Pope will also be attending that. And I think it's a unique opportunity because this particular Pope happens to be pretty popular even outside of the Catholic Church. And so, I'm not Catholic, but I tend to follow what the Pope is saying because he's a celebrity and he's interesting and people find him interesting. And so I do think it's an opening. I know there's a lot of stuff in the works, and there's a lot of effort on the part of the Catholic community to plan events for September and really to use this to make sure that, where there are, folks that will be running for office in 2016 and maybe thinking about what their platform would be on climate change, that they're very aware that there is strong public support for action on climate change and that there is a moral element of this that will be highlighted in the Pope's encyclical.
Great. Good. Okay, so let's try Boston Metro West. Does somebody there have a question? You didn't need to *6 your phone to unmute it. takes a second sometimes, Q. Boston Metro West, do you want to ask a question?
Yes, can you hear us?
Yeah, sorry, go ahead. There, we can hear you loud and clear now. Go ahead.
No problem. So we're so intrigued by your organization, and we were wondering how it might be, well, I'm curious to know, like, how would you, do you analyze different groups' agendas and then kind of partner them up with other organizations whom you think could help sort of strengthen them so they're more than the sum of their parts, so to speak?
Yeah, so I should say I actually just started in November of 2014. So I'm there at the end of November 2014. So I'm very new. But what we have right now is we have a series of listservs and ways that people can find each other and surveys that we do periodically. So one of the really important things we do is get a survey of what each of our member organizations has prioritized, and then we share that back out with our full membership so that people can find each other directly. Another thing we do is we try to mediate small group conversations around the tricky issues rather than ignoring them. Not because we think that we can get people to the point of agreement on these tricky issues, but rather because we want our members to understand where each other are coming from. And so, you know, natural gas is a very contentious issue with our community, as is nuclear, the targeting of the Congressional Black Caucus by our opposition by the fossil fuel industry has been a really contentious issue. So part of what we do is also try to get together these small group conversations. And then a big part of what we do is just try to educate each other about each other's work. So you know, the Pope's encyclical is a great example. We'll be having a webinar on what the heck is an encyclical, and what does this mean, and how can your organization plug in. Similarly, our communities that work in the Gulf South are working very, very hard on Gulf South Rising and these anniversaries, and so we'll be sharing with our full membership what they can do to be supporting our members that are having very, very big moments at any given point in time where you know, we really need our full membership to amplify their work. So that's a big piece of it, too, is raising up and amplifying when we need to, and have member organizations that we'd really like everybody who can and feels aligned to rally around that.
Wow, thank you so much. It sounds like you're kind of a cross between the UN and Match.com for various
Oh, you get a bonus point, Boston Metro West, for that. Okay. All right. Let's try Aaron in Canada. Does somebody have a question up there? People get below and unmuted. You'll have to star 6 to unmute yourself. Give them one more second. Okay, well, then let's bop down to Santa Clarita. Cher, does anybody have a question in Santa Clarita today? And again, you would have to do the same thing.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Tia, thank you very much for being here. I'm so glad to know what your organization is doing. It's fabulous. I have just a kind of specific question. We have a group that's working with farm bureaus and agriculture, and I was wondering if any of your organizations are going that route to try to get some of the carbon emissions sequestered through agricultural methodology.
Absolutely. So thank you. We have a huge chunk of our membership that does work on rural issues, but also a lot of our big, huge member organizations. We have probably about 10 groups that I would consider what we call the big green groups. And they all have elements of their offices that are working on that. And some of them have local offices all over the country that are working on sequestering carbon in the soil and looking at agricultural practices. And agriculture is really, it's a sector that's so important in the context of climate change because it has major impacts in terms of, there are major food security impacts and impacts on agriculture from climate change. But there's also a real potential to either exacerbate the problem with agricultural practices or alleviate the problem by really sequestering a lot of soil carbon in the ground. And so there's a huge chunk of our organizations that work on that. When we were originally formed in 1989, there was probably a slightly larger chunk that worked on that because that was a really huge part of the international negotiations in the early days was what was called land cover and land use change. But there's still a number of our organizations that are pretty focused in that direction.
Cool. Great. Well,
you're
welcome. If it works for you to stay on for the second half of the call, we're going to go over some of the things that happened since last month and review the results, and then just some really interesting meetings. We're going to get a report from the group that lives in Boehner's district about the meeting they had with his office. We are going to talk about the outreach we're doing on farm bureaus, and then really some remarkable stuff in Ontario that the Toronto group did. So if you can stick around for the next 15 or 20 minutes, that would be awesome. If you can't, certainly understand. And thank you so much. It was such a delight to have you on. We wanted you way back in the, it's not way back, WWF days, but so glad that we could finally get you on, and thank you for making yourself available.
Thank you so much for having me, and really thank you for all of you, for all that you are doing. It's so incredibly important, and Boehner is a great example of where, I think there's a good chance of moving him when you move into a year with the Pope's encyclical, and you see, people of faith that can be moved by, or one hopes can be moved by common sense and a good moral argument. So thank you very, very very much for all that you're doing. Unfortunately, you have to jump off just because I have my 4-year-old running around downstairs right now, doing Lord knows what. but thank you very much.
All right,
for having
thank
me
you so much. We'll see you soon.
All right, take care. Bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye bye. Okay, well, that was great. Can we get Amy Bennett for a second to just get a quick recap of what happened in a couple areas? Are you there, Amy?
Yes, Mark. Yes, Mark, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. First of all, here's what I'd like to do real quick is, it really takes till the month of January to get a full list of everything that happened. In 2014.
Yes, Mark, and thanks, everybody, for sending in your reports. You're fabulous. A little recap here. We've got meetings with Congress and Parliament. Our total for 2014 was 1,086 meetings. Editorial board meetings was 47. Letters to the editor was 2,253. And op-eds, 291.
Wow. Really solid. And then, so the biggest month we've ever had in letters to the editor was last November when we had 244, and how many did we get for the month of January so far?
It's incredible, Mark. Letters to the editor total for January is 262. Amazing.
Wow.
This is a new interplanetary record.
New interplanetary record. Excellent. Okay. Let me just say to everybody, for every group, let's make sure we're maximizing the benefit of those letters with our members of Parliament and our MPs and our members of Congress. And that is, we want to make sure that we're getting those pieces in front of them. And that wherever possible, when we get letters, when we get op-eds, let's make sure and mention our member by name and why they in particular could support our solution. 2 weeks ago, we saw some really interesting votes in the Senate of 5 Republican senators voting to say that climate change is significantly contributed to by man-made, and 15 saying that man contributes to global warming. We should make sure that the people like the Rand Pauls and the Orrin Hatches that are on there, that every time we get a letter that's in Kentucky or is in Utah, mentions that this is the kind of person that should be able to vote for this. There's all kinds of reasons we could make it. Rand Paul, you could cite his libertarianism would be a reason that he should support it. With Senator Hatch, we could certainly say that he prefers a market-based solution over using regulation, and that let's make sure that, A, the 260-plus letters that were published this month, let's make sure copies get in front of our members of Congress. And as we go forward, continuing to reach out to our papers with letters and op-eds, let's make sure that we're mentioning every single time why our particular member of Congress should be able to support our legislation. Okay, I want to start with Nancy in Springfield, Ohio, to talk about the meeting they had with Boehner's office. After that, I want Danny to talk about something we'll be doing in the conference that relates to it. Then we want to go to Toronto, where some really interesting work was done, both with the Pricing Carbon event and with the Toronto Star. And then we'll go up to Washington to talk about the work with the Farm Bureau. So, Nancy, first of all, are you there in Springfield, Ohio?
Hi. Should I go ahead?
Yeah,
so
go
I'm
ahead.
Nancy.
What? Yes, go ahead. We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm Nancy from Springfield, Ohio, and I'm not a Catholic, but I live in Speaker John Boehner's district. And last year I was trying to be a good listener, so I asked his aide, why has John been pushing immigration reform? And he said, well, he's a good Catholic, and Father Ed has been talking to him. And I thought, hey, I know Father Ed. So I told Father Ed I'd buy him lunch if he'd come with me to talk to the aide. But he wanted me to talk to their social action group first. So our group leader, my husband, Steve Schlatter, did a great job going to the Catholic social action group. And then Father Ed invited some other Catholics to come, and he included Pam Wong, who's the director of social action for the Archdiocese, who had been at the social action meeting, who also happens to live in Boehner's district. And I invited another new convert, a Republican Catholic. I was very happy about that, who's concerned about climate change. And then I started to get excited. I thought, could we get John to meet with the Pope? Well, I didn't know he was addressing Congress, so I guess that will happen. But Madeline said that we have a connection with a scientist from the Pontifical Academy. And so at lunch, the Catholics all recommended the revenue-neutral carbon fee and dividend. And for our ask, I said, well, I know that John has said that he's not a scientist, but do you think he'd be willing to meet with the church's scientist? And so John's chief of staff and John, schedule permitting, have agreed to meet with the Pope's scientist. And also our aide arranged for Pam Wong's delegation of 20 Catholics from Ohio to meet with John's staff next Tuesday. So at our lunch, Father Ed talked about what a wonderful experience it is to meet with the Pope, and Pam Wong suggested John could ask to be part of the delegation when the Pope visits Philadelphia. So I'm just hoping and praying that John will listen to the church on this matter, and if you could ask any Catholics you know to write letters to John, that would be great.
That's fantastic, Nancy. Thank you for being creative and for starting where you said you started, by listening and seeing what would come from that. So that's just fantastic. We're thrilled about it. And then
that's
Danny,
what you taught us to do, you know. And
right.
I thought, how could I connect with this man? You told me to listen, you know, and that was the first thing I heard.
Great.
You know, he was involved in immigration because he's Catholic.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful, Nancy. Thank you so much. Congratulations to everybody there in Springfield. Great. And so, and then, Danny, could you talk about the new initiative we're going to create for the conference that kind of ties on to what Nancy was just sharing?
Absolutely, Mark. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read something that Madeline wrote. So as much as it's possible, please envision my voice as Madeline's voice. So this is what Madeline wrote. Lots of us have probably seen and been inspired by the movie Selma recently. One of the things that struck me was Martin Luther King Jr.'s powerful call to white allies to come to Selma and march with the SCLC after the violence of their first attempt to march. Thousands of people came, especially ministers and rabbis and other faith leaders. It was so uplifting to see that huge crowd marching together. I began to wonder if we could do something like that. What if we had a faith leader in all our lobby meetings this summer in D.C.? Could we collectively invite and inspire enough pastors, rabbis, ministers, and priests to join us? The 100 Faith Leaders Project launched in my head. 100 faith leaders come to D.C. to train with us and lobby with us and get assigned to members of Congress that share their faith. We ask them to make a three-day commitment to attend the conference. If you would like to help us reach out to chaplains, religious colleges, seminarians, and faith-based groups like Interfaith Power and Light and reach this goal, join the 100 Faith Leaders Action Team on CCL Community and or email Madeline at madeline@citizensclimatelobby.org. And Madeline is M-A-D-E-L-E-I-N-E, and it's at citizensclimatelobby.org. That's it.
Great. All right, Danny, thank you so much. Really clear. Okay, so let's go up to Toronto. Yannick, who's going to give the report on the Pricing Carbon event that you put on and what happened as a follow-up to that?
Hi, Mark. It's Cheryl McNamara in Toronto. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Lovely. So I'll make the report. So Toronto had a very busy month due to an extraordinary opportunity that has arisen in Ontario. So in October, CCL Toronto volunteers met with Glenn Murray, who is the Ontario Minister of Environment and Climate Change. The minister wants Ontario to go carbon neutral. Yes, carbon neutral by 2050. He asked CCL to bring together representatives from industry, First Nations, unions, and NGOs so he could present his vision and find out how to build political will to support it. CCL volunteers Kathy LeCroix and Sharon Howarth delivered in a really big way. They brought in more than 30 reps to the minister in December. Ontario said it will choose a carbon pricing mechanism. The question is, which one? Ontario seems to be leaning towards a Quebec-styled cap-and-trade system. CCL, of course, wants to change the government's mind. In January, Kathy LeCroix and Lynn Adamson brought in 55 people for a day-long workshop and strategy session to recruit more CCL volunteers and strategize on advancing Minister Murray's vision and, of course, ensuring that the government chooses carbon fee and dividend. Based on CCL's leadership involvement, the minister's office has just asked CCL to do something very special. Now, this is confidential at this point, and we look forward to announcing what we've been asked to do shortly. Well, this is happening. CCL Toronto co-sponsored a very important carbon pricing forum on January 27th. The 400-seat theater was very close to selling out, thanks in part to the promotional efforts of CCL volunteers. And key politicians and policy advisors from the federal and provincial level attended, thanks in huge part to the efforts of Sharon Howarth. We live-streamed the event. A huge thank you to Yannick Trottier for making that happen. And to date, we've had more than 500 views. The audience seemed to respond favorably to carbon fee and dividend presented by economist David Robinson, and they asked tough questions of those who advocated for cap and trade. The very next day, thanks to CCL, we got an editorial board meeting with the Toronto Star. They interviewed one of the panelists, Nick Rivers, who wrote the paper, The Case for a Carbon Tax in Canada. The meeting went very, very well, and the editorial board said they would like to follow up with Nick in the future. Now, just a quick note on that editorial board from the Toronto Star. In mid-January, Gord Barthos, who writes the editorials on climate change and solutions for the paper, he sent me out of the blue an email asking me what carbon pricing mechanism I thought would be best for Canada. Clearly, my relationship-building efforts with Gord are paying off. I sent him Nick's paper and, of course, reminded him of the merits of carbon fee and dividend. Now, Gord's editorial, which came out about a week or so after, strongly emphasized and endorsed a BC-style revenue-neutral carbon tax. He did not mention fee and dividend, but the editorial was fabulous nonetheless, and it will definitely help with our lobby efforts, particularly in Ontario. That editorial generated 5 printed and 8 online LTEs from CCL Toronto, Erin, Sudbury, and Lanark. And we did some follow-up trim tabbing as well. We tweeted the link to the LTEs to Minister Murray and other MPPs and MPs. So, Mark, in the months ahead, they will be very critical in convincing Ontario to pick carbon fee and dividend as its mechanism of choice.
Fantastic. Everybody up there, thank you so much. So inspiring. I mean, we just keep getting all these updates about what happened. It's amazing. Thank you. Okay, great. Last report from the field, Alex Amonette. Just as kind of a follow-up of one of the questions with Kia, is obviously agriculture is going to be a big issue for us, and you're building an outreach effort in that area. Can you share with us a little bit about that?
Sure. So CCL has Agriculture and Farm Bureau and Commodities Farmers Action Teams, which everybody can sign up for on CCL Community. And as part of this work, about a year and a half ago, Ellie Sparks contacted the American Farm Bureau and visited several times with one of their directors for congressional relations to find out what he thought of our carbon fee and dividend legislative proposal. And last June, Ellie and CCL volunteers met with him in Washington, D.C., seeking an endorsement. But he said that we needed to get State Farm Bureau support for the fee and dividend, and then the American Farm Bureau would consider it. So the Farm Bureau has a policy on climate change which states in part that they support, quote, market-based solutions rather than federal or state emission limits, being used to achieve a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from any sources, and the inclusion of the agricultural community, as a full partner in the development of any policy or legislation, unquote. And so that's what we're doing. For the past 9 months, I've been talking with the Washington State Farm Bureau. Volunteers in our Tri-Cities chapter and Danny Richter have talked with the Washington Potato Commission, who said that our proposal is, quote-unquote, palatable. Several other CCL volunteers have contacted their county and state farm bureaus and other commodity growers, like the California Almond Board. Since mid-January, I've contacted many of you who are now reaching out to your state farm bureaus, and I emailed 24 volunteers this past week to ask for your help. So would you, if you're not already doing so, please let Ellie know if you can do this outreach. In just 6 weeks, at the end of March, we're holding 4 one-hour conference calls for the farm bureaus to discuss the fee and dividend and REMI study with Danny Richter and Scott Nystrom in each of the 4 time zones. And on June 24th, Ellie has scheduled another meeting with the American Farm Bureau, and we hope to take the 50 states' Farm Bureau endorsements with us to that meeting with your help. We're very excited and happy to say that Dr. Jim Hansen will attend that meeting. So I just want to say it's been my pleasure working on this with everyone, and thank you.
Great. And Alex, how many Farm Bureau liaisons do we have at this point?
About 21.
About 21. That's amazing progress in such a little time, and what we want is one for each state, right?
Correct.
Fantastic. Fantastic work. Thank you so much. Thanks for taking the initiative, and really, really exciting, because we can't get there without dealing with the ag industry, and this is the perfect solution as far as I can tell. Okay, everybody, I want to go over the Canadian and U.S. actions, and then we'll put a wrap on it. So in Canada, we are asking people to write letters to the editor using this month's Laser Talk, to set up meetings with the editorial boards, and as you also see in the action sheet, there's a special Valentine's Day planned action with postcards and everything, which I think is just fantastic. So let's keep the pressure on in Canada. In the U.S., we're asking everybody to write a letter to their member of Congress. We gave you all kinds of talking points, but I particularly like to focus on the Senate, because let's remember that 2 weeks ago, every Democrat in the Senate voted not only that climate change is real and human activity significantly contributes, but they also voted saying that it was real. And that saying that it was real and that there is some contribution, that human activity contributes to climate change, all these Republican senators voted for that amendment. Alexander of Tennessee, Ayotte of New Hampshire, Collins of Maine, Corker of Tennessee, Flake of Arizona, Graham of South Carolina, Hatch of Utah, Heller of Nevada, Kirk of Illinois, McCain of Arizona, Murkowski of Alaska, Rand Paul of Kentucky, Portman of Ohio, Rounds of South Dakota, and Toomey of Pennsylvania. And voting saying there was significant contribution, these 5 Republican senators, Alexander of Tennessee, Ayotte of New Hampshire, Collins of Maine, Graham of South Carolina, and Kirk in Illinois. I just think it's really, really important that people hear from us when they make those kinds of votes of how much we appreciate it. And given that every Democratic senator voted for it, if you write your member of the House, that's great, but let's really love the Senate for making that vote. Also, we are trying to do something we've never done with the conference before. So this year, we are working to get all of the bios and schedules out to people before the conference. Now, for that to happen, a lot of things need to happen, and we don't have wiggle room to say, well, here you're going to get your schedule Sunday night. I mean, that's our fallback position. But what we would prefer is to get everything done, all the bios updated, that if you can do bios in districts outside of yours, that you can take on doing those. There's instructions for how you get to Ricky Bradley and say if you want to do it, and then we'll go over how to update the bios with you. But if you are asked anything in advance of the conference, like we asked everybody who was a liaison to get back to Amy and identify that, in fact, they were a liaison and they'd be the person asking for the appointment. If you're someone doing a bio, if we could just add an extra sense of urgency because I think it makes sense that if we can get the schedules to people ahead of time, and you would get more time to talk to people in advance of the lobby meetings, it gives us a chance to make sure that every particular meeting can maximize the impact it can make. So the second action is around people volunteering to take on bios in districts where they don't live. And then the third thing, we should all give a big shout of thanks to the La Jolla group that put together that video that we've sent out to everybody. We're asking you to watch the video 2 minutes with your group and talk about what you could do it. Let me just give you an example of what one person told me about where we have over 30,000 views on Facebook. She said posting the video, even with a clever short description, got hardly any shares or likes. What did work was a personal message to Facebook friends of hers who had more than 1,000 friends themselves asking them to share the video. Over half of these friends did post to their friends, exposing our video to thousands of people. So everybody, that's a great month. Starting the year with 262 letters to the editor is a great way to start things. Let's keep up that kind of pressure for the rest of the year. Have a great month. We'll talk to you the first Saturday in March. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.